Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America is having another gun moment. Last month's shooting of Louisiana Republican Congressman Steve Scalise reinvigorated the gun control conversation, at least for some. The National Rifle Association drew a lot of attention, favorable and disgusted, from a posted video calling on its members to fight the violence of lies with a clenched fist of truth. In a twist, many lawmakers have used the example of the Scalise shooting to call for looser gun laws. This hour, On Point, looking at America's new gun battle. You can join us on air or online. Where do you come down on the gun debate? Did Sandy Hook, Orlando, or Alexandria sway your opinion in either direction? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first from Wormleysburg, Pennsylvania, is Republican Congressman Scott Perry, whose 4th district includes Gettysburg and areas around the state capital, Harrisburg. He's a founding member of the Second Amendment Caucus and has sponsored several pieces of gun-related legislation this term. Congressman Perry, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, that reference to several pieces of gun-related legislation, what have you proposed and how would it change things?
Well, one of the things that I'm a co-sponsor on is the State Reciprocity Act. And right now, where you might have a concealed carry permit in your state, it's maybe not acknowledged in a bordering state or maybe even not a bordering state. And what it does is it restricts individuals. For instance, I just talked to an individual 2 days ago who's a truck driver, and he said, you know, he feels concerned for his safety, especially at some of the places he stops, but he doesn't want to flout the law by carrying a concealed weapon across state lines. This particular legislation offered by Mr. Hudson of Carolina would allow individuals to carry concealed as long as they complied with each individual state law in the states they were in. So they would have to have a concealed carry permit in their own home state, and then also comply with the laws of other states. But it would allow people then to carry their concealed weapon across state lines. So it comports with the 10th Amendment and the Second Amendment and enables people to defend themselves and provide for their own safety as opposed to waiting for the police to show up after the fact. And that's a really important piece of legislation that we would like to see at least debated and considered. There's also proposed legislation regarding reciprocity in Washington, D.C., in the District of Columbia, which has very strict gun control laws. And in the case of Congressman Scalise, had his security detail not been there, there's a very good chance that that would have been a much more horrific story and a much greater story, because those members of Congress and individuals, whether members of Congress, but also civilians or staff members that were close by, would have been sitting ducks, so to speak, in the face of an armed individual who was bent on their injury or death. And they would have been able to do likely very little about it to defend themselves. And we think that unfortunately, while that's an unfortunate, obviously, incident and occurrence, it is an opportunity, if you will, to discuss that particular issue in Washington, D.C., and how citizens in the District of Columbia are thwarted from availing themselves to the Second Amendment right and defending themselves.
In both cases, you want to pass a federal law, a national law, that overrides the ability of localities to control their own regulations regarding guns.
Well, that's not necessarily true. Certainly in the District of Columbia, the Congress is, we are the ones, it's a district, it's not a state. And so it's wholly appropriate for Congress to be as enumerated in the Constitution. It is within the Congress's purview regarding the District of Columbia. And in the other states, we're not telling them how to adjudicate their own laws or what's important to them or how to enforce those laws. We're saying that from a national level, because the Second Amendment does cross state boundaries, that we want people to be able to operate, so to speak, or to be in those places and be able to defend themselves under their laws, using their laws and complying with their laws, but have that ability to have that reciprocity, that as long as you're complying with their laws, that you can be there lawfully and protect yourself. So we're not saying that they can't control themselves in the Second Amendment or their laws in their communities. We want to be in compliance, but we want to be able to avail ourselves to their laws. Right now, you're not able to.
But if you are crossing a state that doesn't allow concealed carry, if you're extending your own concealed carry permit to right. cross those state lines, you are raising one state's legislation over another's, aren't you? The sovereignty, right, the control, the controlling legal authority?
The bill I've signed on to, the Hudson bill, doesn't do that. It acknowledges and recognizes the individual states' laws and says that individuals would comply with those state laws. So, for instance, if your state law did not allow concealed carry, then the Hudson bill, that law, if it ever became law, would not apply. You would have to have a concealed carry law in that state already, and then it just allows people from another state to comply with that law, because your provisions, obviously, in your state might be different from another state. So if I get a concealed carry permit, let's say in Pennsylvania, and I want to go to Connecticut, and Connecticut has different provisions, maybe they say you have to pay a different fee or you have to provide different information, then I would have to comply with that as well. What we're saying is, as long as I comply, even though I have a Pennsylvania concealed carry permit, but if I comply with another state's concealed permit, then I should be able to travel to that state and conceal my weapon and have it as long as I'm in compliance with their laws. That's all we're saying.
Now, in the case of D.C., you're absolutely correct that the Constitution gives Congress the authority over D.C., but the principle of the thing, the voters of D.C. have repeatedly, in various referenda and local initiatives, said we like our gun laws the way they are.
But the United States Constitution supersedes individual states or political enclaves in certain instances, and the Second Amendment is one of them. And so while we didn't allow individual states, let's just say individual states that liked segregation or something in a civil rights fashion, maybe they like those laws that they had in their individual states as well. But of course, we have civil rights laws at the federal level that supersede those states. This is the same circumstance. Individual political enclaves like Washington, D.C. can't abridge their citizens' rights to their Constitution, their constitutional rights, because they like to or because they don't like what the Constitution says. And in this case, in particular, because it is enumerated in the Constitution, it is wholly appropriate that the Congress decide for Washington, D.C., as the political enclave controlled by the Congress, what its citizens should be able to do or not do regarding their Second Amendment rights or all their constitutional rights.
Congressman Scott Perry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the opportunity.
Joining me now from Washington is Lois Beckett, a senior reporter for The Guardian, where she covers gun policy, politics, and criminal justice. Lois Beckett, welcome to On Point.
Great to talk to you.
Is the sense of the Congress now gathering behind measures like the one Congressman Perry described to extend concealed carry across the country?
There's certainly tremendous support among many gun owners and gun rights activists, among many Republican members of Congress. Concealed carry reciprocity has been one of the NRA's biggest priorities for years, and their huge support for President Trump, I think, gave everyone expectation that this would be a priority in the coming months.
And D.C. has been something of a beach ball, both in the courts and in struggles on Capitol Hill. What's the state of play there? They've lost in the Supreme Court, haven't they?
Yes, D.C. was one of the holdouts that really restricted the ability of Americans even to own guns in their homes for self-defense. And with the Heller case, that was rejected and really shaped in line with Americans' public opinion that that we do have a right to protect ourselves and own a gun for self-defense in the home.
We've become all too accustomed to the gun control debate flaring up again after mass casualty shooting. The interesting thing with the terrible shooting of a congressman, and he's still in very serious medical condition, is that in this case, we heard for calls for loosening gun laws following the shooting of a congressman.
I think if you're looking from another country at the United States and you hear about a mass shooting that targets members of Congress and just really a horrific incident in which a congressman called in and described shortly after it happened, seeing a colleague shot, dragging himself across the baseball field, leaving a trail of blood, feeling that they all could be killed instantly, you would assume that there would be big change and that gun laws would tighten. But that's not how many Americans look at this, and that these were many Republican members of Congress with strong A ratings from the NRA, a real commitment to gun rights, and their immediate reaction was, rights have consequences, but that doesn't change my opinion on what I think about gun ownership in America.
It's interesting that in the case of this shooting, which happened in Virginia, which has very, very permissive gun laws, there's an assumption that changing the laws in D.C. would have changed the outcome in the Scalise matter. Now, maybe there's something to that because a lot of people just rode across the river from D.C. to begin their day and head over to practice in Virginia. What do you make of that?
I mean, this is the classic argument from the NRA and from gun rights advocates, which is the patchwork of laws between states is really difficult and inconvenient for gun owners, and that you might choose not to defend yourself if you don't want to worry about, okay, my gun is fine here, but if I cross the border, it's not. And that's what Congressman Loudermilk said almost immediately after the shooting. You know, if I had been in Georgia, my staff, we would have been armed. But here, we just weren't, and that's terrifying.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're taking a look at the gun debate and some of the proposals to loosen up the nation's gun laws. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the new NRA video? Do you see it as an all-but call for a kind of civil war? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Lois Beckett, a senior reporter for The Guardian who covers gun policy, politics, and criminal justice. And Lois, a lot is made of the partisan divide when it comes to these questions. I'm wondering, as you cover Congress, is there a regional or form of built environment divide? Are suburban and urban members of Congress likely to see this issue in a different way from rural and exurban members of Congress, regardless of party?
I think what you're seeing, especially in the latest Pew survey of gun ownership, is that there's actually a stronger partisan divide when it comes to opinions on things like the NRA than there is even between gun owners and non-gun owners. That the partisanship of the gun debate is sort of overdetermined, and that you see more here is about your loyalty to a party than it is even about this practical question of whether you want to own a gun or not. But it's certainly true that there are huge regional differences in opinions on guns and gun ownership. I was actually late last month in Nucla, Colorado, a tiny town that after the Sandy Hook shooting passed a local ordinance requiring everyone in town to own a gun. And that ordinance is incredibly popular, and everyone there is very happy to have it required by law that every household should have a gun.
So we're not likely to see defections in either party on either side of the question based on what kind of district they represent?
Well, what we do know about American politics is just that people are self-segregating bipartisanship more and more. So there's this clustering of political beliefs that people are more likely now to live among people who share their beliefs than to have that mixed. So no, regionally, it doesn't look like the geography of the opinions on guns in America is changing.
Joining me now from Stanford, California, is John Donahue, a law professor at Stanford's who's an expert on gun policy and the criminal justice system. He's just out with a new report about right-to-carry laws and violent crime, and you can find a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. John Donahue, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray.
And with me from Boulder, Colorado, is Dave Koppel, an associate policy analyst at the Cato Institute and the research director of the Independence Institute. He's author of the 2013 book, The Truth About Gun Control. Dave Koppel, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Now that everybody's on board, the two of you and Lois Beckett, let's listen to that much-talked-about National Rifle Association video that was posted online and has gone viral. It stars nationally syndicated radio host and NRA spokeswoman Dana Loesch.
They use their media to assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. They use their movie stars and singers and comedy shows and award shows to repeat their narrative over and over again. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance. All to make them march, make them protest, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, burn cars, shut down interstates and airports, bully and terrorize the law-abiding, until the only option left is for the police to do their jobs and stop the madness. And when that happens, they'll use it as an excuse for their outrage. The only way we stop this, the only way we save our country and our freedom, is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Well, we've come a long way from weekend gun safety courses in that video. John Donahue, when you heard that, what did you make of it?
Well, it was distressing. I think anything that emphasizes an us-them view of the United States is both divisive and also dangerous. I think a lot of NRA commentary that we should be looking at our federal government and identifying tyrants and using the Second Amendment as the way to take out the tyrants is very unhelpful thinking, and the sort of thinking that motivated the shooting in Virginia. So I think that's one point that all Americans should agree on, that we live in a democracy, and any idea that the Second Amendment plays a role in stopping what you think is a tyrant is misplaced and dangerous.
Dave Koppel, does this clarify the issue any, or is it just muddy the water?
Well, I'm sorry. I don't think Professor Donahue listened carefully to that ad, because there wasn't anything about tyranny in it. It was about using words to fight back with words against people who are rioting, protesting, and blocking traffic, vandalizing stores, engaged in violent behavior. And the answer was to fight back with it by joining an organization. It's a recruiting ad that uses the First Amendment freedom of speech to present a contrary view. That's what America should be about. That's how we should be resolving our differences, by supporting organizations and disagreeing with each other verbally, rather than what some extremists have been doing with the riots and other violent behavior.
Dave Koppel, with all respect, come on. That idea that it's just a proposition about joining a club, when you listen to the actual language, they, this very large and defined they, use sporadic violence and a sort of cultural tyranny, and we, the only way to stop this, the only way we save our country and our freedom, is to fight this violence of lies with a clenched fist of truth. That's not just a proposal to join a club, is it?
Well, the club is the National Rifle Association, the nation's oldest civil rights organization. Yeah, the clenched fist of truth. It yes, it's a, that's about words. It's when Jesus said, "I'm, you know, I'm the door." He didn't mean he was on hinges. It was a metaphor. And a clenched fist of truth is about First Amendment activity.
But all the violence and all the social tumult in this vision of America is on the other side of the question.
Well, that does happen to be how it is these days. You know, sometimes things go up and down depending on the politics of stuff. But yeah, I don't see Trump supporters rioting in the streets these days.
Okay, fair enough. And we'll start our whip around the country today in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where Nate is on the line. Nate, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for having me. And I was just going to point out a couple things. We in Wisconsin passed a concealed carry law relatively recently. I also want to touch on that video and something your guest just made a remark about. But the Wisconsin experience was that the murder rate went up rather than down with concealed carry being after concealed carry was passed. Also, I saw the video. I saw it as trying to attack the freedom to assemble and the freedom to speech by protesting. And I can also talk about a Wisconsin incident where our governor lied about union protesters supposedly attacking his vehicle in La Crosse. It's in his book, Unintimidated. And I see that as akin to the video conflating and lying about peaceful protesters when the vast majority of protesters are simply expressing their views as they have the freedom to do.
Now, Nate, when you mentioned that you passed concealed carry in Wisconsin and the murder rate went up, that could be a blip. That could be something that flattens out over time. But it sounds like you're convinced that having more people around armed contributed to that.
Not only will I say it contributed to that, but there was an incident where two concealed carry permit holders drove down the freeway in Wisconsin shooting at each other. And the trend has been consistent for a couple of years, if you look before and after concealed carry was passed, in that we do have a slightly higher rather than lower murder rate.
John Donahue, is there any data that speaks to this not only in Wisconsin but nationwide?
Yes, the study that you alluded to earlier that I completed recently essentially evaluates data over the last 37 years and looks at the 33 states that adopted right-to-carry laws over that period. And the bottom-line conclusion from the study was that each year that a right-to-carry law is in effect, violent crime tends to increase by about 1% per year, a little bit over 1%, so that by the time you've had a right-to-carry law for about 10 years, you've experienced about a 13 to 15% higher level of violent crime than you would have had the law not been passed. So the basic experience is that while in some instances right-to-carry permit holders have been able to thwart crime, the overall net effect is that more crime is encouraged by passage of right-to-carry laws than is reduced by it.
Dave Koppel?
I think the flaw in Professor Donahue's study, which I read last night, is that there's a lot of math and equations in it, but it makes numerous mistakes about the laws regarding right to carry. So, for example, he talked when Arizona enacted its right to carry law. That was a licensing law for concealed carry. But before that, in Arizona, open carry without a permit was completely lawful. So it's not such an immediate change when the concealed carry licensing law goes into effect. And likewise, on the comparison states he chooses, it's deeply flawed because the comparison states are so different. You have some states like Hawaii, which theoretically can issue licenses, but in fact never do. And he treats that as a comparison state identically to, for example, New York State, where there's tremendous local variation. And in, say, Westchester County, it may be nearly impossible for a law-abiding citizen to get a permit. But in a great deal of upstate, permits are issued just the way they are in most of the rest of the country to law-abiding citizens who pass a fingerprint-based background check and a safety training class. So there's a lot of apples and oranges mixed up. But one thing I think he's right about is he talks about Colorado, where we enacted our law in 2003, and he says that it led to a reduction in violent crime over about a 10-year period of about 1.25%. Now, that might be a little more precise than reality, but I think what we ought to be doing is focusing on successful laws like Colorado's and see what features they have that could be copied by the small minority of jurisdictions in this country now that don't have some form of a right to carry law.
We've gotten a lot of feedback from our listeners this hour. Anne writes, I've gone back and forth on this issue. Growing up, my dad always had firearms in our house. He hunted, so there were maybe a couple of shotguns and a rifle. He showed them to my two brothers and me, and he talked to us about safety. We never touched them, and I can't say why. I think a couple of people here have talked about all things they went through to get a license, and maybe that's the best we can do for now. People who own guns feel very strongly that this is a right, and good luck taking that away. Mark says there is no debate, no matter what urbanite liberals may think. Figure it out. Shall not be infringed is pretty straightforward. Gun control doesn't work. Look at the violence in Chicago and other urban gang-infested areas. Law-abiding citizens have the right to keep and bear arms. Honest people are being punished for the illegal acts of criminals. Todd writes, more guns is always the answer. Always. Sarah adds, anyone who wouldn't be considered psychologically fit to stand trial for misuse of a gun shouldn't own one. And Eric adds, why isn't it enough that murder and attempted murder is already illegal, that people are so interested in removing the most effective tool used to defend against someone who already doesn't care about those laws? Lois Beckett, covering this beat must be very challenging because of the conflict of law, tradition, passion, and changing winds in the country.
It absolutely is an issue where there's almost no agreement. And this atmosphere that we've all been experiencing recently, where it seems that there are two alternate realities and the news covers them separately and there's just no agreement between them, that has existed in the gun control debate for a long time. But one thing, you know, I've really concluded after many years of covering this is sometimes from the left, there's this suggestion that, you know, how do we just get Republicans to change their minds on gun control? Or how do we get, you know, how do we shift the right on gun control? And really, like, Republicans are not going to change their mind about guns. Gun owners are not going to change their minds. It's a proposition that people have been trying for a long time, and it doesn't work. So the question that most interests me now is, how can Democrats change their minds or their approach or the way they think about guns and gun violence? And if you care about gun violence in the country, you know, how can you reframe how you're approaching this debate, how you're approaching this problem to maybe make more progress?
Why is that any more likely than Republicans changing their mind?
Well, one thing I think that's important to keep in mind is that gun owners tend to actually have a more specific and sometimes a more accurate understanding of the way guns function in this country than anti-gun Democrats do. One huge thing to keep in mind is that we have somewhere between 260 million, 300 million, 400 million guns in this country, huge gun ownership. And so we have a very serious gun violence problem, but you have to put that in perspective, that most gun owners and most guns in this country are never abused. They're never used for violence. They're never a problem. And so what we're talking about always is this very small fringe of people who are misusing guns, who are using them inappropriately, and not talking about the everyday, totally safe usage of guns, people who are using them, you know, not as tools in their everyday lives. And I think people on the left don't acknowledge that enough, that most people are very safe with their guns. And passing sort of condescending laws saying, oh, we need to train people better, or, oh, most gun owners aren't safe, just isn't realistic. Most gun owners are safe, and our problem is people who are very high risk having access to these weapons.
John Donahue, has there been any a change in the national conversation that you've seen watching this issue? And we're just about ready for our break, so I'll take a short version of the answer, in light of recent, very highly publicized shootings.
I don't think there's been any recent change in attitudes, and there is quite a bit of variation around the country. In November, in a referendum in California, by 63%, Californians tightened gun restrictions quite stringently. And now, of course, the NRA has sued in California, trying to overturn the will of the California electorate in that referendum. So there's this continuing debate of whether the people should be allowed to express their views democratically or whether the court should be used to enforce a uniform rule at a federal constitutional level.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about America's new gun battle in the weeks after the shooting of Louisiana Republican Congressman Steve Scalise. You can join the conversation. Is this gun battle just always going to be a fight to the death for the other side? Is there a fighting chance that we can figure this out? I'm talking with Lois Beckett, a senior reporter at The Guardian who covers gun politics and policy, John Donahue, a law professor at Stanford University, and Dave Koppel, an expert on firearms policy at the Cato Institute and the Independence Institute. Speaking just a few hours after Congressman Steve Scalise was shot in Alexandria, Virginia, Governor Terry McAuliffe, a Democrat, called for greater gun restrictions.
There are too many guns on the street. We lose 93 million Americans a day to gun violence. I mean, I've long talked about this. Background checks, shutting down gun show loopholes. You know, that's not for today's discussion, but it's not just about politicians. We worry about this every day for all of our citizens.
And later in the conference, Governor McAuliffe clarified, obviously it's not 93 million Americans, it's 93 Americans who die every day on average. Due to gun violence. We'll go to Charlottesville, Virginia next. Clinton is on the line. Clinton, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a suggestion or a quick point. And these people, they have their guns. I have my guns. And I see it just as driving a car, and that these militarized weapons shouldn't be in the hands of people who are just allowed to drive a simple automobile. If you want a motorcycle license, you got to go out and get a motorcycle license. If you want to drive a tractor trailer, you got to go get a Class A. If you want to drive a school bus, you got to get a special license for that. And I think that people who want the more than just a hunting weapon or, you know, anything greater or a little more technical should have to probably pass a series of tests for the safety and use of these weapons rather than just going to some gun show and buying it right off the shelf and walking out that day.
Clinton, I understand your point, but is it complicated by the fact that the Constitution says what the Constitution says? There's no mention of special license classes for school buses and tractor trailers, but there is a Second Amendment that says that you can infringe the rights to own a gun.
Absolutely, and I think that the Republicans and the responsible gun owners could probably get behind some sort of a license. If you put the death toll versus gun violence or gun accidents versus vehicle accidents per year, I haven't looked at the numbers, but I'd say they're pretty close and just as equally dangerous.
Dave Koppel?
Well, Illinois is one of the very few states that requires a license to own a long gun, and the criminal who shot at the baseball practice had gone through that process and gotten one. So that's why, for example, Governor McAuliffe, with just this knee-jerk reaction of we need more gun laws and then just reeling off some of the top talking points, was off target. We need to be thinking with more specificity about what particular laws are helpful and which ones are not. The great news is on accidents, they have declined by about 90% in the last four decades, and even more for gun accidents involving children. So that is a tiny fraction of the gun problem. And when Governor McAuliffe was talking about, you know, gun violence, which is the latest buzz phrase, instead of saying, oh, we're for gun control, now they say we're against gun violence. The very large majority of gun deaths in the United States are suicides. And it is questionable whether, even if you could ban all guns, that would have might make much difference on the suicide rate. Japan almost bans all guns, and they have a suicide rate twice as high as ours.
John Donahue, what about that idea that nothing we do, and you just heard Dave Koppel mention various laws that don't stop these terrifying numbers in their tracks?
You know, one thing that my study tried to say is that one law that has been implemented widely in the last 20 years or so is extending the right to carry guns outside the home, and that does seem to increase the level of violent crime. So that's one area where I think great caution is needed. And we started off the program with the congressman discussing trying to extend right to carry beyond one's own state, and that seems to be a bad idea if you're concerned about violent crime. And of course, you know, we have many guns, so that makes the issue of appropriate regulation tougher. But there are many, many areas where most Americans feel very strongly that increased gun regulation is a good idea. So universal background checks is overwhelmingly supported in the United States. But unfortunately, the Republicans in Congress have been attentive not to the people of the United States, but to the whim of the NRA and have tried to thwart the adoption of universal background checks. So there are many things that we could do. And of course, it's important to keep in mind the experience of Australia, which had a very serious problem with mass shootings, as the United States does. And in the wake of their 1996 horrendous mass shooting, they were able to get very significant gun control and have not had a mass shooting since then. And on a daily basis, I will receive emails from Australians saying, we can tell you, as someone who's lived through gun control, that it does make life better. So at the very least, I think it would be important for everyone to acknowledge that there's certainly evidence that moving in a different direction than we have would be helpful. And then at least the debate would be premised on some factual predicate rather than the somewhat magical thinking that we heard about congressmen thinking that if they had had their gun while they were playing on the baseball field, they would have been able to stop that mass shooting. It's important to note that the FBI has noted that it virtually never happens that any mere citizen with a right to carry permit plays a useful or effective role in addressing the problem of mass shootings.
Earlier, Dave Kopel, you mentioned the long gun licensing law in Illinois that did not prevent the shooter in the Northern Virginia congressional shooting from getting a long gun. Doesn't that put a heavier than rational burden on a law? We don't expect car safety regulation to drive the automobile death rate down to zero. We don't expect food safety laws to drive food poisoning down to zero. We just expect it to reduce it. And maybe it does reduce it.
Exactly. And that's the point we should be thinking about gun laws in general, is we know that guns in the right hands enhance public safety, and guns in the wrong hands are very dangerous to public safety. So we need to think with some nuance. Instead of just a knee-jerk way about looser laws, tighter laws, we need to think about the specific laws. As Professor Donahue's study showed, the Colorado's right to carry law reduced our violent crime rate by about 1%, which is a lot of crimes when you add it up over now a 14-year period. In Colorado Springs, because we have right to carry, a mass shooting at, you've never heard of this, a church in mega church, the New Life Church in Colorado Springs, was stopped by a church volunteer who was serving as security at the church that day. And according to the pastor, she saved over 100 lives. That's may not make a statistical difference in a national scale, but it was sure pretty important to those people. So we need to think about the details of particular laws, including the differences among right to carry laws. In Colorado, a person can be denied a carry permit, even if they pass the background check and the safety training, if the sheriff has evidence that the person would be a danger to self or others. And if there's a dispute about that, it goes to court and the sheriff has the burden of proof. That's an example of a sensible and moderate law which should serve as a national model. Rather than just thinking about more or less laws, we ought to be thinking about specific, sensible, moderate laws.
Let's go next to Manchester, Tennessee. Debbie is on the line. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I want to get back to the female guest. I didn't catch her name, but
Lois.
Her generalization mm-hmm. about liberals and guns is just astounding. I'm a liberal. My husband has a concealed carry permit. we raised our children with guns in our home. Of course, we kept them under lock and key. We taught them to respect the guns. And I don't think Democrats want to take people's guns away. That's a big hyperbole. And regulation is also in the Constitution under the First Amendment. So, you know, I'm willing to agree, yeah, moderate laws, sensible laws, not overreaching laws. But when I saw that NRA ad, I was just livid because it was divisive. It was pitting one group politically against another group politically. And, you know, as I recall, and there's even armed militias that still show up at protests to counter-protest. So I don't get why the NRA thinks that ad is just about speech, because I'm just not buying it. And the NRA lost me a long time ago when they went political and started pitting people against each other over this.
Debbie, thanks a lot for your call. Jesse is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell a story. I'm from a small town in Mississippi called Pearl, Mississippi. I don't know if you would remember it or not, but maybe a year or so before the Columbine High School shooting, there was a high school shooting there in my hometown. At the time, I was in middle school, but the shooter, a high school student, he killed two people and injured, I think, 5 to 7 more. The news reported that it was his plan to go on to the middle school and continue to shoot. However, the principal of the school actually had a handgun in his car and was able to stop the shooter. And so, going back to what one of your guests said, that the FBI statistics say that people being able to carry guns or own guns don't stop murders, I believe that's absolutely false. I think it happens more than we know.
Lois Beckett, talk to Jesse about that. I mean, that is very much part of this argument that you'll often hear, that people say, look, as Dave Kopel mentioned in the mega church in Colorado, as our caller Jesse just mentioned in the school in Pearl, there are incidences where an armed person stops the commission of a crime and saves lives. And they're very much those events are very much part of this debate.
I think one of the challenges here is whenever you start a conversation on gun violence with mass shootings, you're already talking about a relatively small number of events, a very tiny percentage of America's overall gun violence problem. So it's easy to draw conclusions one way or another looking at these things. No, it wouldn't help. Yes, it helps sometimes. And that misses the bigger picture, which is 20,000 gun suicides a year and gun homicides that are clustered in neighborhoods of tremendous disadvantage, disproportionately burdening young men of color. So we obviously have to talk about mass shootings, but our conversation is usually upside down. It starts with the small number of particularly horrific events, and it misses what we can do to help the majority of people who are impacted by gun violence in America and by gun death in America, and misses thinking about what would happen if we started with the people who are most effective, who are white men in rural areas dealing with suicide, or young men of color in particular neighborhoods, and went there to them and tried to understand the context, not just of guns, but the broader context of mental health and police reform, and tried to work from that up towards what our policy should be, rather than going from outrage to outrage driven by emotion, which hasn't taken us very far in the gun debate in America.
Dave Kopel, Lois Beckett is right that mass casualty shootings comprise a very tiny percentage of all the people who are injured and killed by guns in the United States every year. So let's widen the lens. If there are 51 jurisdictions, the 50 states and the District of Columbia, if you take the 17, one-third, where gun ownership is the highest, and you line it up with the 17 where gun deaths are the highest, there's a very high correlation between those 17 places.
That's exactly right. And that there is one of the things there's a lot of consensus on among social scientists is that when gun density increases, the percentage of suicides which are committed with guns goes up. Now, whether that affects the overall suicide rate, that's a big debate continuing among social scientists. But as in Professor Donahue's paper uses percentage of guns, what percentage of suicides are committed with guns as the proxy for gun density in an area. You know, there's no question if you have more guns, you'll have more gun suicides. Whether you have more total suicides, not so sure. But Ms. Beckett's also right about the general point that the mass casualty thing is something that the anti-gun groups need to focus on because that's sensational and gets attention in a way that the much more routine, you know, inner city violence just doesn't get suburban voters very concerned.
To be honest, pro-gun groups focus on them as well by justifying that if everyone was packing, these crimes would be short-circuited and circumvented.
Right, which happens sometimes, but of course not always. There's too much magical thinking on both sides. On one side, it says, oh, guns are when somebody commits a crime with a gun, the pro-gun people will say, oh, but they could have committed the crime with something else. Sometimes true, but not really true for, say, a scrawny 15-year-old who's trying to rob a liquor store. If he didn't have a gun, he probably couldn't perpetrate that crime. And on the other side, there's this claim that, oh, guns are useless for self-defense. They never succeed. Well, according to the Federal Centers for Disease Control, which is not one of the top pro-gun organizations in the country, they did a study in the 90s and found that guns are used defensively against home invasion burglaries about 600,000 times in a year, usually without a shot being fired. Just the presence of the gun is enough to convince the burglar to end his working day early.
Quick response, John Donahue, before we say goodbye.
Guns are used defensively sometimes, but of course it's nowhere near 600,000, maybe one-tenth of that or less. And guns are stolen at about 600,000 times per year. Let me just quote to you from the top law enforcement.
No time for a quote. I think there is argument and tension around the methodology and the numbers that are arisen. I just wanted to see if you agreed with that number. Lois Beckett's a senior reporter for The Guardian who covers gun policy. Lois, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for talking.
John Donahue is a law professor at Stanford University, an expert on gun policy and the criminal justice system. Sorry to cut you off, but we got to go. We appreciated your time today.
Thanks, Ray. Thank you.
And Dave Koppel, a firearms policy expert from the Cato Institute and the Independence Institute. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Continue the conversation online. Get the On Point podcast. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.